Thank you for tuning in to Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM. I'm Livonia Mallory.
And I'm Mark Dunley. We have a great program planned for you this hour.
Today we have YouthFX, an organization that helps young people find their voice by producing films about their life experiences.
Next, Tatiana Morani shares another episode of Food Fun Day as she interviews co-owner Heather Levine about the yummy food at Peck's Arcade.
We will hear a piece from Dave Pablo as he visits Soulfire Farms in Grafton to learn about their efforts to combat racism.
We will then chat with Sand Lake Town Clerk Barbara Bitting about her recent election.
We'll finish with a special coverage of a diversity panel with PEF and David Soares and Mayor Kathy Sheehan. Now, for headlines. Projects in the city of Troy will receive $10.3 million from the latest round of the state's Regional Economic Development Council Awards, while projects in Cohoes get $2.1 million. The Troy Record reports that the largest single award among local cities was $4 million for the Troy Innovation District Project, which includes building renovations to provide interconnected wired buildings to accommodate demand for technology companies. Other Troy projects include $700,000 for Capital Roots to build an addition to its Urban Growth Center in North Central, $500,000 for Burden Ironworks Museum in South Troy, $360,000 for Rensselaer County Historical Society, and $2.9 million to allow Hudson Valley Community College to establish an advanced manufacturing training program.
New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman says he'll lead a multi-state lawsuit to stop the Federal Communications Commission's repeal of net neutrality. Schneiderman, who had pushed for the FEC to investigate a flood of fraudulent public comments on the vote, called the move by the FCC an illegal rollback that would reward those who perpetuated this fraud in service of their own hidden agenda. Schneiderman says his analysis shows 2 million comments stole the identities of real Americans, including dead people and children. State officials are also exploring options to maintain net neutrality at the state level.
James Field will face a new charge of first-degree murder for driving into a crowd protesting a white nationalist rally in Charlottesville. Prosecutors upgraded the second-degree murder charge he previously faced in the August 12th collision in Charlottesville that left 32-year-old Heather Hayers dead and more than three dozen injured. Field's case now moves to the grand jury for indictment.
33 students have been suspended from the fights that erupted at Albany High School last week. The fights had been brewing and erupting earlier in the day, spilled outside after a student pulled a fire alarm. 10 students were arrested for fighting, and another student was charged with felony falsely reporting an incident for pulling the fire alarm.
The Lafarge cement plant in Ravenna may start burning garbage. The state of Connecticut is looking for a place to burn garbage after an incinerator in Hartford that took waste from 70 communities was shut down. Connecticut is looking to choose from among three possible sites by the end of the year. The cement plant located across the street from a school has apparently already received permission from the state to burn garbage as one of its fuel sources.
Senators Rubio and Corker announced today that they will vote yes on the Republican tax bill, clearing the way for congressional action before Christmas. The bill will give sharp tax cuts to corporations and the wealthy while adding more than $1 trillion to the deficit. The Senate is rushing to act before the newly elected Democratic senator from Alabama is seated, especially since Senator John McCain is still in the hospital. The Republicans said that they would release the text of the bill Friday night. For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to WOOC's Hudson Mohawk Magazine on 105.3 FM.
To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
Our first segment discusses creative filmmaking with YouthFX, an organization that helps young people find their voice by producing films about their life experiences.
So, we're so glad to have some special guests in the studio with us today. Why don't you tell our listeners who you are and what you do?
My name is Darren, and I'm the Assistant Director of YouthFX. I'm also a filmmaker. I've been with YouthFX for the past 10 years.
My name is Ijanaya. I am a member of YouthFX. I've been with YouthFX for going on 6 years. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so I make films and then I help teach in some of our programs. And yeah, lots of other stuff.
Cool. My name is Aiden. I've been with YouthFX for about 8 years, and I'm currently studying film documentary studies, to be specific, at the University of Albany.
So my name is Balan Suchak. I'm one of the co-founders and the executive director of YouthFX.
I want you to tell me what this organization is all about.
So YouthFX is an organization that works with young people primarily in the city of Albany. Our age range is between 9 and 24. So we have a wide range of programs. And ultimately, the goal is to teach young people how to kind of take control of the narrative when it comes to creating films and digital media. We do short documentaries, narrative films, music videos, and we also have recently started a production company that was formed by people that had gone through the program who have sort of aged out but are still continuing to work with our organization.
Yes.
And those videos are intended to help create a level of financial stability and sustainability for the program while also helping people in the community, nonprofits, organizations, young people maybe starting a brand new enterprise or business to create video content for their websites or social media. So one of the things that we're really interested in doing right now is really trying to figure out ways that we can create a program that is able to not just teach young people, but provide a pathway for them to become a filmmaker or a media maker as a career path.
Well, that's a big goal, making filmmakers, producers. But I like the idea of them controlling the narrative. Tell me a little bit more about that.
I mean, when I first started YouthFX, I came in because I wasn't seeing images of myself on TV, and I hearing stories that I was familiar with. And so I was really determined to learn how to make my own films and share the stories that existed in my community. And so I feel like it's really important to have representation. And I think as youth being like the most targeted audience, why don't we have access to the tools to represent ourselves and like the stories we have and the stories we like to tell? So
it must give you a real sense of power, empowerment, strength to be able to control the images and the stories that are told about you.
Yeah, I mean, you have old white dudes making billions of dollars off of our image and getting it incorrect. So why can't we put out our own image and put it the way we want to put it? And also, we jokingly say in YouthFX that film is an excuse to build community. And so out of that, out of creating our films, it's such a collective process. You'd be out of your mind if you tried to do everything by yourself. And so we all come together from different backgrounds with different skills and different ideas. And when you bring it all together, it creates this dynamic mass of amazingness.
So what brought you to the Sanctuary tonight? Because, I know our listeners can hear a little entertainment going on in the background. Why did you come to the Sanctuary tonight? What was going on that you needed to come and see?
So there's a really cool event that's happening that I actually didn't hear about until a couple days ago, probably last week or something like that we were invited to come sort of be a part of this great workshop. with this guy, Jonathan, who directed this film called Quest, which is making the rounds right now in theaters. And I think what drew me when I heard about it, and I think all of us, is kind of like the way that the film was made and sort of like the type of filmmaking he was engaging in, very community, very sort of like grassroots, independent, was kind of what we do, and also what The Sanctuary engages in as well. So I think that's probably why we're here. I think just to experience that and to connect with someone from not from where we are, but doing kind of the same thing.
To learn. To share and to learn. So, you know, I'm really excited about the possibility of coming to see what you guys are doing. I think I have an open door invitation to come down, right? So I want to come see you. Tell us where you're located. If you have a contact information for the group, tell us where the organization is located, address, telephone, Facebook, yeah. Whatever.
So this is a really actually very exciting time for YouthFX. We started the organization in 2008, and we are about to enter our 10th year as an organization, which is very exciting. And we recently, actually as a matter of fact, just yesterday, moved into a brand new space, which is, you know, in many thanks to the Albany Housing Authority and the City of Albany for supporting our program and actually finding us a home, which is going to be a dedicated space just for us to do production work, to do shoots, to do workshops, education programs, and film screenings, and all sorts of cool stuff. The space is located at 25 Warren Street in downtown Albany, in Albany South End, which is really an incredible neighborhood with lots of great community activity happening and incredible work happening from a lot of different groups and organizations. So our building is right across the street from the Capitol South Campus Center. It's 25 Warren Street. You'll see we have a sign up so you can actually identify us. And yes, please come through, because I think if you come to our space, what you're going to see is that you will really see that the organization, that YouthFX, is really about creating a space and a community for young people. And I think that what I love about it is that on any given time, there's all sorts of different activities and projects happening. And because we all kind of are working together in different projects, that people kind of learn and feed off each other. And I think it's something that really creates like a larger and more kind of collaborative process when it comes to creating art.
So what days of the week are you open?
So, I mean, right now, so like I said, we literally just moved in yesterday. We don't really have open hours, but you can just reach out to us via email. Our contact information is, you can email us at info@youthfx.org. We also are on Facebook at YouthFX and at YouthFX Film on Instagram and Twitter. So yeah, please hit us up. Right now we don't have like scheduled times that we're going to be, you know, like open hours, but we are going to start that process once probably the New Year's comes in and we actually are finally settled in the space. It's really a process of us to kind of get to the place where we actually have our own space. So we're trying to figure out what that's going to look like as far as having open hours and workshops and things like that. But you can find us online and reach out to us. We're pretty good about getting right back to people.
All right. Thank you so much for coming in. 105.3 FM, WOOC.
Those were members of YouthFX, an Albany-based organization that helps young people find their voice by producing films about their life experiences.
On another note, it's Food Fun Day, one of my favorite. On the Hudson Mohawk Magazine this week, we sent WOOC correspondent Tatiana Moraney to Peck Arcade to talk to the co-owner about Yummy Foods.
So, Heather, what made you want to open up Peck's Arcade?
Funny thing about that is probably 2-3 months into the confectionery, people kept saying, oh, you need to open a restaurant. You need to open a restaurant. And Vic, my partner, and I looked at each other and were just like, there is no way we will ever open a restaurant. Like, just way too many headaches. The confectionery is great for us. This works well. Here we are 5 years later, and things evolved in a way. So many things evolved in ways that we could have never imagined. And one of those ways was the opening of Peck's Arcade, our casual fine dining restaurant. What made us want to open it? Again, I think it came down to seeing there are lots of incredible restaurants in Troy. Let me start by saying that. Many of them were here well before us. And these are places that I will frequent all the time. Like, I love going out to eat in Troy. We But we opened PEX just seeing that there was a little bit of a hole for the type of dining that we wanted to offer. And that specifically, PEX Arcade is a vegetable-focused restaurant, not 100% vegetarian or vegan, nothing like that. But our focus is definitely on vegetables, house-made pastas, seafood, and then we do some meats as well.
I agree. I think vegetable-focused food is something that is hard to find in many cities, in addition to Troy. So I think it's cool that you guys are doing that. So talk about the menu, since you kind of have this different focus of food. Talk about what's on the menu and why it tastes so good.
Yeah. So if you come into PEX, there are a couple of – first of all, the menu is always changing. But there are a couple of categories that you always have to hit, or a couple of items that I am saying. Like, if you're coming in for the first time, these are must-dos. So there's one dish on the menu that's been there since day one. Literally only one dish. Everything else has changed or been altered or come off or come back, come off and come back on. But we have a mushroom dish that's on the menu. It's mushrooms cooked in brown butter with hazelnuts. And it is sort of, I guess, I don't know if our chef, if Nick would kill me for saying this, but maybe it's kind of our signature dish at this point. I mean, Nick, he did leave it on the menu. He has left it on the menu entire time, so he can't get upset with me for saying it's the signature dish, I guess.
I've had this mushroom dish, and it's very, very good. It's very, 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 very good. So I think I didn't realize that it'd been on the menu the whole time, though. I didn't even actually realize that the menu changes. I don't pay that much attention to detail.
It probably changes multiple times a week, actually. It certainly changes every week. But then there are a couple of dishes that will come and go even throughout the week.
So since you're focused on vegetables, do you try to stay like in season with the vegetables?
Absolutely. Right now, one of the dishes that is absolutely killing it and fits with the season is a squash pancake dish. So it's very similar to, I guess I would say closest to something like, or in between, like the idea of a scallion pancake and some sort of German potato. Like somewhere in between those two.
I love that idea. So another thing I want to know about is do you guys create the menu yourselves, or do you look to like cookbooks, or how do these items come to be?
So our executive chef and his team, Nick and his team, it's 100% them. I mean, they have free rein to come up with all of whatever dish that they want, to be completely honest. At the beginning, we all sat down and talked about the style of the menu that we wanted, but from there, it's 100% them.
And so you knew what kind of food you wanted.
Yep.
Did you know Nick before you opened up PEX Arcade, or did you just so happen to come across this amazing chef that you just had to have in PEX Arcade?
Nick totally found us. At the time, prior to us opening PEX, he was working at the wine bar in Lark Street as the chef there. And after he finished his shifts there, he would come over to the confectionery and have a glass of wine. I mean, this probably happened like 3-4 days a week. And we would just start chatting and then chatting some more. And then he heard rumblings that we were talking about opening something. And he decided that, like, he wanted to be that guy. Like, he wanted to be the person leading the charge. And I remember distinctly, Vic and I chatted with Nick, and then we took him almost immediately to New York City to check out some restaurants that really inspired us. We all came back here and chatted, and sort of like it was a little rocky at the beginning, making sure we were all on the same page. But shortly after that, we really just hit the ground running and haven't looked back.
It's amazing. Beautiful, beautiful. So talk about the ambience in PEX Arcade. It's a smidget different than the yes. other places, but you can definitely still see, you know, the vision.
Mm-hmm. We focus on doing all of the technical things right, so providing really great service and really great food and great wine and doing those very tangible things well, but not in a stuffy way. And so it's I would call the restaurant high energy as well, in terms of both the way that everyone moves across the room, the type of music that we play, how loud the music is. The restaurant can be very romantic, but I would not say that it's quiet.
I think that's an accurate description. That's really, really cool. How did you come up with the name Peck's Arcade?
Again, history. This one goes back to more or less the same time period of Lucas Confectionery, but it was much more brief. So Lucas Confectionery, again, was around for just about 100 years. Peck's Arcade was like 2 or 3 years, and it was actually a department store. But the name just resonated with us. Again, it sounded, there's some fun in the name Peck's Arcade. And while we wanted to take, we do take everything that we do very seriously, we still want it to be fun.
Right, of course. Food should always be fun.
The most fun. The most fun.
If people want to learn more about Peck's Arcade, how do they go about doing that?
Peck'sArcade.com or Peck's Arcade on Instagram. We also, to access all of our businesses, if you go to ClarkHouseHospitality.com, that's the overarching name of our hospitality group, you can find more info as well.
And since your menu is changing so much at Peck's Arcade, do you guys keep it up to date online?
If there's something specific you're looking for, I would definitely say call or pop in, because it's not, while it's a good representation of the types of dishes that we offer, it's not always up to date.
Thank you, Heather.
You're welcome. Thank you.
So that was Heather Levine from Peck's Arcade, which is located at 217 Broadway in Troy, New York. If you want to check out other previous Food Fun Day segments, have a listen to our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast at mediasanctuary.org.
For those just tuning in, I'm Mark Dunley.
And I'm Lavonia Mallory. You're listening to Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM, Troy.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Evening Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org.
WOOC correspondent Dave Pablo paid a special visit to Soul Fire Farms in Grafton in October to learn firsthand about the campaign to end racism in the food system.
This is the second part of a two-part series about Soul Fire Farm and the latest edition of our series on farming in the Capital Region. Back in October, I took the opportunity to visit Soul Fire on Community Day. I spent the day out there working, talking to people, to get a sense of what the farm is about. Soul Fire is all about community and education and empowerment, and they have a very clear set of goals.
Well, hi everyone. Again, my name is Leah Penniman. I am one of the co-founders and farmer program managers here at Soul Fire Farm. Yeah. And I'm super happy that you're here. So grateful. We're gonna do about a 30-minute tour and talk, and you can like ask questions throughout. And Amani will be joining in a moment, if she's not already here, and do some of it with me. So Soul Fire Farm is a project that was officially born in 2011, although we did start working this land in 06, and it took us that chunk of years to build the home that you probably use the bathroom in, which is a straw bale timber frame solar home, and to get the soil to a place where it could support plants. This was a highly degraded piece of property where the land had been logged, the soil had been all washed down the hill, just leaving behind clay and rock. And so we've done the best we can to honor the legacy of the Mohican people, who are the rightful owners of this land, the First Nations people, by making it better every year and by using a lot of indigenous and traditional African methods to do so. The mission of Soul Fire is to end racism in the food system. What we mean by that is right now, the people who do the work to grow the food are not the same people who get to eat good food and not the same people who get to own land. And there's a long history of that, starting with the genocide of First Nations people and moving through enslavement and convict leasing and sharecropping and guest worker programs like Bracero. There's a really long history of land and food being used as tools to oppress people, especially people of color. And so we're trying to rewrite that story. And the three main ways we do that is, one, we have a farm, right? And our farm specifically grows food for people who otherwise would not have access to that food. So we do a doorstep delivery of a box, bushel box of like 15 items every week that goes to families in neighborhoods living under food apartheid. Food apartheid is that system of segregation that allows some to have food opulence like Whole Foods and farmers markets, and others not even to have enough nourishment to be able to learn and to be able to survive. We have an epidemic of like diabetes and heart disease and obesity in our communities that's directly tied to what types of food are available to people. So that's the first thing we're trying to do. The second thing is about training, equipping, and inspiring the next generation of farmers and food justice activists of color. So if you come here in the middle of the summer, at any given time, there's tents all over the place. That dishwashing station is popping, the music is popping, and it's because there are 20 to 30 folks on week rotations coming through to learn and then be part of our alumni network. And so we do Black Latinx Farmers Immersion, we do an Uprooting Racism Farmers Immersion. We work with youth, we have a youth immersion and youth day programs. And the last thing we're doing is movement building. So we are part of a national alliance called the Heal Food Alliance, as well as the National Black Food and Justice Alliance. And we try to gather up all the information about what's broken in the food system and pressure the people who have power to change those things and to give up their power. So that's policy, that's corporate organizing, that's like, you know, grassroots exchanges of reparations and things like that. So that's like the big picture overview of what we do.
The other co-director of Soulfire is Jonah Vitale Wolf. I had a chance to talk with him as we worked in the greenhouse clearing out the space for winter.
So one of the major impediments for people getting into farming is just the economic end of it.
And I mean
that extends from acquiring new land to developing that land and building up a market. Mm. Could you maybe give me an idea of how you approached all of those things?
Let's see. So the economic end, yeah, it's tough. I mean, like, we live in a hyper-capitalist economy, which bases its wealth on not valuing land and labor. And so our farming system, since its inception in this country, has been based on stolen and unpaid labor. And so that has not changed, where it went from legal slavery to sharecropping to convict leasing. And today, after, you know, the Great Migration, you have 4 or 5 million African Americans moving north from the South. Someone's got to replace that labor, and that labor has been systematically replaced with Mexican, Caribbean, Latin American labor through the H-2A program. And so it's a system in this country that is not designed to support the people doing the work. And it's only natural that in a system that does not value its labor, that it would consolidate. So what we see, people say the food system, we got to fix this food. The food system's working exactly as it was designed. And so we're really trying to look at creative ways for people to integrate both food growing and food education into like all of their lives. So a lot of our graduates may not be farmers, but they are community chefs, community organizers, health workers, you know, like, and what does it mean to be not only connected with land, but then the skills around that is deeply healing and deeply powerful in terms of what you can actually do. And we're working with like the farmer census to actually acknowledge urban farmers as farmers now. And it's things like that. So I think there's certain ways around land acquisition, like land link programs, aging out farmers, of connecting people. There's a little bit of like NRCS, which is a USDA branch, funding around low interest loans, favoring minority and women and beginning farmers, stuff like that. But it's just not much. So the finances of it are tough. As a farmer, everyone's got to be a hustler. You got to have your thing. Our thing has been education. We kind of consider it in a way one of our value-added products. So we're not hustling at farmers markets or making the jams and the sauerkrauts and stuff. But that's what farmers got to do, having like really efficient systems. Also like the collective kind of environment of doing things. For us, it looks one way. For other people, it might look another way. But I think there's a way you can look at sharing equipment, sharing materials and supply ordering, even sharing land and having creative land access arrangements that are like long term. I mean, it's a...
And this is with other farmers in your area?
We do a little bit of that. I mean, again, we're a little bit of an island because we're not in like prime farm area, but there are examples out there. And I think,
know, but I like what you've done with this.
Thank you. I mean, it's, you know, again, it's like we don't do outreach for like any of our stuff. And I think it speaks to how relationship based we are. Mm-hmm. Like it's just been about caring for our community and also about meeting the needs of like what people are really asking for, not like not going the other way around. Oh, I really want to, you know, do this thing, so you need this. But actually really having our ear to the ground based in relationships.
When you go out to Soulfire for Community Day, you have a chance to contribute, but you also have a chance to learn. And Leah, especially, and Imani take every opportunity to instruct people on their methods.
One way is copying other farmers. So that's what you always do in your field. But probably in a deeper level is we're always trying to look to our indigenous and ancestral African practices and figure out how do we adopt those. And also how do we credit those? Because there's the whole like permaculture movement, like much respect to y'all if you appreciate that, but it really is just taking indigenous ways of knowing, rebranding it, mm-hmm. and making college educated white, mostly men wealthy mm-hmm. off of like permaculture certification programs. So mm-hmm. we're not really down for that. And so what we're trying to do is give true credit. Like these raised beds, those were started in what is now Kenya in the Ovambo region. The whole idea of like raised beds, you know, intercropping simultaneously arose in what is now like the central plateau of Mexico and sub-Saharan Africa. So all these techniques we're using, obviously people didn't have like roll plastic back in the day, but they did use banana leaves and other things to mulch and smother. And in the island where my mother's from in Haiti, people do that technique. And so we're always like, what our ancestors do, because they held it down, they were able to feed the community without destroying the earth. And how do we continue to uplift and bring those methods into the light? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So one thing that I love about this space too, when we're talking about indigenous ancestral practices, this terracing system also simultaneously arose in Mesoamerica and sub-Saharan Africa. In Africa, it's called fenyaju, which means throw it upwards, because you literally take the soil that's eroded down the hill and you throw it back up to make these little steps, right? These terraces were actually built by Oaxacan farmers who are friends of ours from down further in the Hudson Valley. Right after we got back from Mexico, we were very inspired around terracing and invited some friends over, and they like showed us how it's done. So normally a slope like this, you know, you wouldn't plant on because you're going to lose everything into the woods. But making these steps holds it in place. We have the apple trees, and around the apple trees we have some chives to keep away the pest of the apple tree. And then we have things like rhubarb and sage and bee balm and lemon balm and mints. And all these herbs aren't just random. They're all things that actually are what our community needs most. And the people who come to the farm. So it's about lowering blood pressure, anxiety, depression, sleep, immune boosters, concentration enhancers. And so we will come down here if someone needs something, pick it, make the tea, and do what we can to heal ourselves.
I also had an opportunity to talk with volunteers. This is a recording of Forrest, who has been out here many times.
I'm Forrest Lyons.
And you're out here doing volunteer work?
Yes, I am.
Have you? Is this your first time out, or you've come out a lot?
No, I've been with these guys since 2013, I think, for the BLFI, Black Latino Farmers Immersion Program. And I've been coming back ever since. About once or twice a year.
Cool. Tell me about that program.
It's a program where they're teaching people of color about land and land sovereignty and growing your own food. And it's a, I think, four or five-day workshop. From that, you know, people brought back what they learned to, you know, community gardens or their backyards. And, you know, some people are trying to start their own farm, things like that. Like, as far as for me, I'm just learning about farming and gardening so I could apply it to my, you know, mental health job, teaching kids about healthy food, getting them off the meds.
So tell me about your job.
I'm a youth counselor. And it's, you know, working with children that have ADHD, oppositional defiant disorder. So my title is behavioral assistant. So I'm trying my best to incorporate nutrition with mental health. And it's not an easy thing, I'm learning.
I would think, because I've done some farm work myself. I did a couple internships out in Washington State, and I'm doing some stuff around here too. Just the actual physical action of working in farming would be great for mental health. Are you able to bring your kids out here at all?
Not yet. I haven't tried, but I'm going to discuss that with Jonah and Leah. They're the owners, about like maybe ending like the last session, bringing them out here for a day and volunteering, because it helps, you know, it's therapeutic.
I'll close with a recording I took just before lunch that day, when the volunteers and workers and alumni all gathered around, essentially to celebrate what they were doing together. I'm Dave Pablo for WOOC.
All right, so for our gratitude, we're going to do a one-word grace. So your job is to think of something that you are grateful for. When it's your turn, call it into the middle. We're going to echo it back to you. All right, in the end, we'll give a big ashe, and we can enjoy the food. So we will start with Mishima.
Sunshine.
Sunshine.
Oh God, Mary. Community.
Community.
People.
People.
Empowerment.
Empowerment.
Friends.
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 Education.
Education.
Friends.
Friends.
Carrots.
Carrots.
Excitement.
Family.
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 Friends. Friends.
The gray and white cat.
The gray and white cat. Laughter.
Love.
Love.
Peace.
Love.
So that sounded like a fun workplace. But that was Dave Pablo interviewing members of Soul Fire Farm about their amazing work.
Up next, we hear from WOOC correspondent El Delfonso Apple Ames, a professor at SUNY Albany who follows Rensselaer County politics. He spoke to Barbara Bidding, the newly reelected Sand Lake town clerk.
I was wondering, Barbara, can you describe this experience running for office once again and getting reelected? How was it? Did you have to go out too much in the community? Do people know you already? How is the relationship with the
Well, I have an advantage because I've lived in this community for all my life, and everyone knows my name, which is good, right? Name recognition. So I have a lot that I have to stand up for because the name means something in this town. Cool. I've run for a lot of offices. I was a receiver of taxes, now the town clerk, day camp director, worked for the school as a truant officer. So I have input with students, their parents, their grandparents. So I've always felt that that's a good thing. That gets me votes because they know I will do a good job.
So now this office is being run by some Democrats and some Republicans. How is that? How
in
is that working?
In my office, my deputies are, we're not all the same party.
And how does it work?
Fine.
Fine.
Because we make it work.
We make it work.
We respect the people in the town. We are here to do a good job for the town. We get paid to do a good job for the town. And I have extended my hours to evenings until 6 on a Wednesday night. Saturday mornings, I do passports here, which you will not find a town clerk locally that does passports. We do notary service. We do hunting, fishing licenses. We do millions of things. I refer to myself as the mother of the town. As the mother of the town, it doesn't matter whether what party you are.
So you've been here for how long?
In the town clerk's office, 10 years. Receiver of taxes for 16 years. Day camp director for 17. And I work for the Able Park School District for 37 and a half years.
Wow.
And I'm 74.
What can we say about voting? How was the voting turnout for this town and for the county overall from what you have heard?
I was told in the beginning that it was heavy. But after looking at some of the numbers, it wasn't. I just think that people just don't utilize the fact that they should be voting, whomever they vote for. Even when I campaign, I say, you know, I would appreciate your consideration, but if you don't, just get out and vote. That's your one right. That's the only way you can touch the world or touch whatever you need.
And what do you think are the issues that we are currently going through in terms of the in our particular town and overall in the county?
I think every small town has the same issues. Same issues. We all have high taxes. We have things we want to change. It's just, it never changes. I look at some of my board meetings back to 1970, and the things that were issued in 1970 are still an issue today.
And what can we do to resolve that? How is that the local
people
government?
People working together. Get closer together. Hopefully the new group coming in will work together. I mean, I've always said that whoever's there, I serve the people. I have to answer to only one person. That's the people that vote for me.
Yeah.
And they will tell me if I'm not doing good, but they won't vote for me, or they'll be calling me on the phone. So although I don't have any expertise that I can vote on any of the things, the board members do, but I, again, the mother of the town, I hear it all.
Okay, and let me ask you one more question, and that is, with this new term, what are the expectations that you have for yourself and for
the
individual?
We have a new supervisor coming in.
Yes.
Our other supervisors retired, but I've through here, I probably worked with 18 different people in the office of supervisor. They've all, as I said before, we're leaving our mark. You're going through, you're just a person. You're leaving your mark here. You hope you do good and leave it for someone else to move on. So this group that's coming in, I have high expectations. They're nice people. I'm sure they'll do just fine. And I'll be there to help them.
And can you share with us a little bit of what are the things that they might be doing that will continue to improve our community?
Well, we got a new zoning code. They're all working on that. They're trying to improve on that. So each group that comes in tries to add a little to it.
And what's the difference between this new zoning code and the one that we had before?
Or
the one that
more restrictions. You'd have to. I really don't deal with that.
Okay.
So I'm just the minute person who takes the minutes, but there's changes. And sometimes I think a lot of perception out there, people just don't hear it right or whatever. Maybe more meetings. They'll be more open with public and let them know what's going on. That would be good.
You mean for the individuals who meet together just to make sure that the meetings are open? I mean, the meetings are open.
Are open, and our meetings are televised on TV.
But people don't know?
They do, or they can't get those stations on their TV with that going on. But a lot, we are also on a website where you can go out and listen to our meetings.
What is that website? You remember?
townofsandlake.us.
And then you go up there and
you can listen to a recording that tells our meeting. You can listen to it.
Absolutely fascinating.
Since I've set that up.
Wow. Well,
we're very open. That's good.
That was WOOC correspondent L. D'Afonso Appleaines speaking about the recent election of Sand Lake Town Clerk Barbara Bidding. Up next, we have a presentation of a panel discussion by PEF employees and public servants David Soares, the DA of Albany, and the mayor of Albany, Kathy Sheehan, to discuss diversity during a roundtable discussion entitled Addressing Diversity in the New America.
I can't breathe, the famous words uttered by a dying black man, Eric Garner, on July 17, 2014, in Staten Island, increased the awareness of movements like Black Lives Matter, founded on July 13 of 2013, due to the acquittal of Trayvon Martin's murderer, George Zimmerman. So that's a little bit of history of why Black Lives Matter was created. And the kneeling of the national anthem during the 49ers' final preseason game on September 9, 2016, by 49ers football quarterback Colin Kaepernick. Are these types of protests necessary to address what many believe is the proliferation of police brutality and killings in communities of color? What are your suggestions in addressing police brutality? And as stated, you can talk about women's issue and LGBT issues, try to fit it in somehow. Thank you.
So protest absolutely is necessary, and people need to make their voices heard and come together on these issues. You know, many of you know that we had a death in custody of an African-American man. and that to this day there are people who come and protest and demand that I fire the police officers that were involved in that stop. And one of the things that I talk about is that, you know, you can fire two cops, that's not going to change a police department. You can fire people and you're not going to change a culture. It's not that easy, right? If all it took was firing people, we would have, you know, dealt with these issues decades ago. And so what I had to do as a mayor was look at the facts of the situation, right? Where you have the U.S. Department of Justice reviewing the entire incident. And it was a tragic death. This was a man who should not have died in police custody, no question. Nobody wanted the result that we got that night, nobody. Not the police officers involved, not the community, not anybody. But when faced with the U.S. Department of Justice, the district attorney's office, and our own internal investigation, had I fired those two police officers, they would have sued the city, they would have had their rights under civil service, and based on the facts and information that were available, they would have been restored to their jobs. And we would have spent hundreds of thousands of dollars and we would have accomplished nothing. And so what we have focused on is, what do we need to do using 2020 hindsight, using that hindsight, what is it that we need to do as a police department to ensure that something like this doesn't happen again? And that included implicit bias training that is continual. That included the fact that we now train all of our officers with respect to this individual was mentally ill, with identifying mental illness and seeing mental illness, not just our crisis intervention unit. It also spurred us, we were already working towards body-worn cameras, but it encouraged us, we were encouraged by working with the entire community, including the NAACP, on what are the rules gonna be around how we use body-worn cameras and what we do in our department. We have to change how we see one another. And that is work that is ongoing, and you never can declare mission accomplished. And the other thing is to, again, recognize and call out racism, right? I mean, I was very unpopular with our police officers when I talked about this, because I said, our reputation as being racist has been earned. It's been earned, right? I mean, you know, and it's not just the cops that were standing at the end of that bridge in Selma and beating the crap out of people. And it's not just things that happened in the 60s and the 70s. We had a police chief who lost his job in 2009 for uttering racial slurs, right? So this is earned. And so when our officers put on that uniform, they have to recognize that what people see, right, in that uniform is they carry the yoke of all of the racism that came before them. And so while those officers might say, but I'm not a racist, right? But you're wearing a uniform. And that uniform carries with it the implicit bias and explicit biases of the people who are seeing you. And somebody has to step up and be the adult in the room. Somebody has to step up and say, I see that. I understand that. I can see why when you look at me as a cop, you're not seeing me, you're seeing a uniform. And what are we gonna do about it?
I don't think I've had a more difficult time in this position than in the last 3 years. Let me repeat that for you. We have not had, as a state association, as a national association, we have not had as complicated and as difficult of a time as we have had in the last 3 years. And I say this against the backdrop of the proliferation of guns and violence in pockets of our communities, right? I say this, the proliferation of illicit drugs and the growth of certain illicit economies, right? The thing that has made this experience over the last 3 years the absolute worst experience for prosecutors and police is having the very community that you serve lose its faith in you.
Yeah. Yeah. Right? Yes.
And that forces you to look inward. Because at the end of the day, I could sit here and say, I think Ms. Mosby is the first prosecutor that actually charged people. I don't know that there were successful convictions. Quite honestly, we were all looking around saying, okay, how does she build this case? Right? when people are outside my door and they're clamoring, because I know they were clamoring for the mayor to fire the officers, there's no one occupying this county that has more information about that particular case, that has reviewed that case, that has reviewed every single element of that case more than the experts in my organization. And those officers did not deserve to be fired. But that's not what you hear, and that's not what is going to be projected to you, because the attention span for when something happens is like this. And then as we go through the absolute, it can almost seem like we're walking through quicksand when we're going through our investigations and looking at our cases. There's nothing sexy about looking at 13 hours worth of video frame by frame to search for evidence. Nothing sexy about that. But at the end of the day, you have to arrive at a certain place. One of the reasons why, quite honestly, that even when you do deliver a result, and that result is rooted in truth and evidence, it's not accepted by the very community that you serve, not because they think you're lying to them, but because there has been a history, right, of poor relations.
Yeah.
Now, what's funny is, you know, after all of these events, you start to see these events take place all throughout the country. We have panels that have been put together all talking about how we rebuild these relationships with community. And I sit back and I'm a student of history. I like history. Love history. And the word rebuild just never really sits well with me, because to rebuild means you had something that existed before.
Right.
Right? Or when we talk about diversity, always take the time to sit with someone who's different from you,
right,
that looks different, who doesn't understand your culture, who asks you questions like, hey, let me ask you a question. And they look around. And he goes, you know, my parents were Italians. When we came here, we were treated like, you know, everybody like takes a turn, right? Being treated a certain way. And how often do you hear this? Well, my family was Irish, you know. When we came here, there was no place for Irish to work. Like, what? You have these conversations, and I take a deep breath, and I step back and I say, because not one of your grandparents, in their experience, ever had the Supreme Court define them as proper.
Mm-hmm.
Because not one of your parents ever, in their existence in this nation, you know, some 30 years later, said, okay, well, you're humans, but we can practice this separate but equal thing, right? That's never happened to any culture in this world other than people of color in this country. And who were those people who then were forced to go out there and enforce those bigoted laws? All of them looked like people who looked, well, who were in this profession. They had badges, stripes, representing the law.
That's all right. I just want to say that I heard your speech,
mm-hmm,
and what you said, but I saw your passion when you were speaking. I could just see how seriously you felt about what you were discussing, especially the history of the Albany police and the criminal justice system.
Albany has gone through... So in 1992, right, in 1992, there was one black prosecutor in Albany County, one. So to go from, and then the numbers within the Albany Police Department, we're just talking about one city, we're not even talking about the entire county. So diversity and issues about diversity and sensitivity to race was not something that has been with us for, let's say, 30 years. I mean, what we're seeing right now is the result of things that has started about 10 years ago. As the mayor said, I mean, we had a police chief here that used insensitive, you know, derogatory words towards people. And I think the system had been routine in how we processed people, and sometimes that's what we fall prey to, is the routine. This is what we do to get through the day. but we're not taking stock as to how what we are doing is impacting on the lives of people. And so, like, right now it's a painful, you know, process of having to, you know, do your own internal check and audit, but it's happening, you know, which is why, again, the last 3 years have just been some of the most challenging.
Yeah, that's what you said. What is the number one? What's the number one challenge you have? You said 3 years has been very challenging, but what's the number one thing you really struggle with right now?
I struggle with the... This might actually take a little bit more time to extrapolate. I think what many activists are doing right now is they're searching for economic redress, greater civil liberties through a criminal justice movement, which is okay. But understanding that even if we raise the age, it's not really changing the conditions of the communities these kids are coming from, right? So what it means is they're coming through a very different portal into the system, but it's not really changing the fact that they're coming through. And so I'm hoping that there's a much more nuanced discussion on criminal justice, because we can keep talking about lowering sentences, we can talk about bail reform, we can talk about discovery reform, we can talk about raise the age. But unless you're talking about, you know, implementing strategies that really redirect the lives of young African American, young people of color, then we ain't talking about anything. You know? We're talking about, okay, so you got less time. You're 17, you're 18 now, you're being prosecuted, you just get less time. It's not changing the trajectory of your life.
So it sounds like you're talking about economic changes, too.
You can't go to the Capitol and talk about criminal justice reform without talking about criminal justice reinvestment, right? You can't have that conversation. If, for example, the reason why illicit drug economies and the reason why human trafficking takes place in certain places is because there are no traditional economies from which people can earn a living from, right? And so when you have, you know, entire swaths of neighborhoods that have nothing, right? Well, everybody's going to eat, right? And so sooner or later, there's going to come an economy that people can, you know, derive income from. And right now, that's the narcotic trade and it's human trafficking. So you can't talk about lowering crime, you know, lowering recidivism. You can't have a conversation about great reentry strategies unless you're also willing to have a conversation about where is the chunk of resources that we're going to come in, that we're going to talk about, trades or, you know, financial literacy or employment for teenagers. Like, if you don't have that, then all we're doing is we're tinkering with a system that is going to continue doing the same thing it does.
Thank you so much for having taken the time to share your thoughts with 105.3 FM, the Sanctuary of Independent Media in Troy, New York. You have an open door to come to the radio station anytime and do an interview there and just talk about some of your vision, some of the things you want to do. Thank you.
I'd love to do it. Thank you.
Thank you. That was David Soares and his position on economic issues in the urban community, and Kathy Sheehan talking about the history of racism with the police department. That concludes our show. Once again, we hope you've enjoyed this episode of Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Lavonia Mallory.
And I'm Mark Dunley, and I want to thank Jonah Moberg once again for being our great engineer. And check us out on our Facebook pages on both WOOC and Sanctuary for Independent Media have Facebook pages. But remember to tune back in weekdays and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news.
To learn more about this program and how you can support Sanctuary for Independent Media, feel free to visit our website at mediasanctuary.org.
If you'd like information on how you can participate in the production of this program or have suggestions on stories you'd like to hear, email us at info@mediasanctuary.org.
If you're interested in being a part of the radio crew here, we hold a weekly meeting Mondays right after the show at 7:07 p.m. You can come by the Sanctuary for Independent Media located at 3361 6th Avenue in Troy, New York.
Until next time, thanks for tuning in.